Many people in this world spend their lives so foolish here, never trusting in the friend in me. The world so big and bold, with all its pleasure and its gold, is just all that they think they will need.
Yes, it brings to me your pardon great, and it points to us who have escaped, and the love of God is all that I need.
Help me, Master, ever to be calm and satisfied down here, never fretful here with anxious greed. And may I know that all is ever well when thou art near, and the love of God is just all that I need.
Oh, the
precious love of God. How is it tenderly pleased?
Yes, it brings to me your pardon great, and it points to hands who have escaped, and the love of God is all that I need.
It is time for another Bible lesson brought to you by the Hamilton Church of Christ. Time, one of man's most precious commodities. How little time we have. How we use it is so important. The Bible cautions us to redeem the time. That is, we are not to waste our time. This is especially true of time spent in the saving of our souls. So let's take some of this precious time now and spend it together in an examination of the Word of God, and endeavor to learn the simple truth that is intended for man to know. No better use can be made of our time than in learning about God and His ways. Won't you join us in this short study today?
As I travel through this land of sorrow and of sorrow, I am facing God's eternity. Yet I never think about tomorrow, of tomorrow. Yes, my God will make a way for me.
I know my Lord will make a way for me. I know my Lord
will keep me glad and free. When I'm sad, all the friends I've had, they will come to make me glad. So that matters not how lonely or how troubled I may be.
I know my Lord
will keep me safe from the harm of every foe.
I know His
love will shelter from the storm, the raging storm. He'll be near when I fear, and my prayer He'll hear.
I know He'll make
yes, my God will make a way for me, a way for me. Every day I'm in the blessed keeping, in the keeping of the one who walked upon the sea. And someday when death comes o'er me creeping,
God will make
yes, my God will make a way for me, a way for me.
I know my
Lord will make a blessed way for me, a way for me.
I know my
Lord will keep me glad and free,
so glad and free.
Sad, all the friends I've had, they will come to make me glad. So that matters not how lonely or how troubled I may be.
I know my Lord
will keep me safe from harm and every harm.
I know His
love will shelter from the storm, the raging storm. He'll be near when I fear,
danger
and my prayer He'll hear.
I know He'll
yes, my God will make a way for me.
As we continue our study in the book of John, we are in the 19th chapter, ready to begin at the 4th verse. Jesus is still in the midst of his trial. He's come through the three phases of the Jewish portion of the trial, when he was before Annas, and then before Caiaphas, and then before the council. And then the Roman portion of his trial began when he was before Pilate. And then Pilate took him and delivered him to Herod. And now here he is, back before Pilate again, the third stage of the Roman portion of the trial. Pilate actually does not believe him to be guilty. And so he, in order to try to please the Jews, he is greatly humiliating him. He's going through with this thing like he is maybe going to crucify him anyway. Verse 1 of chapter 19 tells that Pilate took him and scourged him. He put him through this terrible beating, which would be enough to kill some people, actually. And then he let his soldiers humiliate him. The soldiers planted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put a purple robe on him, and they said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they smote him with their hands. So he's turned loose at the mercy of these foreign legionnaires, these soldiers who are occupying this country from Rome. They certainly know nothing about nor care anything about the Son of God or the Messiah or anything about the law of God. This is not even in their knowledge. And Pilate allows this to happen, though, to completely humiliate the Savior as much as he possibly can. And verse 4 says that Pilate therefore went forth again and saith unto them, "Behold, I bring him forth to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." Here again, Pilate is telling them very plainly, "I do not believe this man is guilty. I do not believe this man could justifiably be put to death. I find no fault in him, so I'm bringing him back to you. I'm pleading with you to now allow this man to be freed, allow him to be turned loose. Let's do the right thing about this. I want you to know that I don't find any fault in him." And so he presents Jesus back to them in this humiliated state. There he is, standing with the crown of thorns on his head and the blood streaming down his face, no doubt, from the puncture wounds of these thorns. There he has been beaten by this Roman scourging, which had an unlimited number of stripes that could be given. It wasn't the Jewish beating that had 39 stripes or 40 stripes. This was a beating that was unlimited. His back then, no doubt, was covered with blood, and the garments would be stuck to his back, and he had this old purple robe on him, and he'd been hit by the hands of the soldier, and he'd been treated similarly by the soldiers of Herod just shortly before this. Jesus certainly was a person that now would be in a most humiliated and degraded and physically exhausted state that you could imagine. And so verse 5 says, "Then Jesus came forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate saith unto them, Behold the man." Pilate is trying very hard now to demonstrate to these Jews that this man is harmless. This man is not a king. He's not going to usurp the authority of a king. He's not any threat to the Roman government. He's no threat to your nation. Look what has happened to him. He doesn't have any followers, evidently. He doesn't have anyone here to defend him. He's been completely submissive. He hasn't done anything to even resist. We've done with him what we please. We've humiliated him in every way you can imagine, and there's no reason for you to have any fear of him. Look at this man. Look at the thing that you are so afraid of. Look at this man that you're accusing of being such a terrible criminal. Behold the man. This is what we're talking about. This is the thing that you brought to me to judge. And he tried very desperately to demonstrate to these Jews that they have nothing to fear from this man, that there's no reason, no justifiable reason to do what they're wanting to do to him. There's no reason to put him to death. And here again we see great evidence of Jesus' innocence. Here's a man who was really an impartial judge from the standpoint of having any prejudice against Jesus. He didn't want to please those Jewish rulers. He didn't want to look good in their sight. He didn't want some kind of a tumult to happen here under his guidance, and then he'd get a bad name in Rome. But at the same time, he stood up for the fact that he could find nothing wrong with this man. He didn't find any reason to accuse this man or to condemn this man. But verse 6 says, "When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify him, crucify him." Now, when they saw here Jesus in this degraded and humiliated and
and beaten and physically exhausted state, they still wanted his blood. They cried, "Crucify him, crucify him." There was no pacifying them. There was no appealing to them. There was no reasoning with them. There was no meeting them halfway. They wanted this thing to go all the way. They wanted him to be put to death. And so verse 6 further says, "Pilate saith unto them, Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." So Pilate simply tells them, if you want it done so badly, you do it. You take him and you crucify him. I don't find any fault in him. Now, of course, the Jews didn't want this. They didn't want to be the ones to put him to death. They didn't want to have that responsibility or that problem thrust upon them. This is something they wanted the Roman government to do. When the Roman government did it, then it would be something that they could really say that we're not the blame of. They couldn't have the people to rise up against them. It couldn't be blamed by the people, because here's something that the Roman authorities, that the Jewish nation already despised and deplored, here's something that the Roman authorities did. And so that's the way they wanted this thing to be brought about. Furthermore, the Jews' law didn't allow for crucifixion. It allowed for putting people to death in other ways. One of their chief methods of execution was to stone someone to death. But nevertheless, they wanted Jesus to be put to death by the Roman authorities. They wanted this thing out of their hands, and they had a problem because the man that could do this didn't find any fault with him. Pilate didn't find any reason to do this. So he turns him back to the Jews and tells the Jews, "You take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him." But the Jews wouldn't give up at this time. They had gotten too far along with their desired result to stop now. They wouldn't let up at all, so they take another approach. In verse 7, the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." So they take another approach here, that our law says the man should die. Reason with us like this, Pilate. You don't see anything wrong from your standpoint, not from the Roman law, but from our law, and we have to abide by our law. Our law says he ought to die. So at least from that standpoint, give us some kind of consideration. Carry this thing out. Go through with it. You may not see why, but our law says he should die. Now here they're appealing to their law, and they were violating their law all along. They were dishonoring their law, and truly they did have a law, and it was a very great law. It had greater statutes. It had greater provisions in it. It was made by a greater lawgiver than any law of any other nation. But they were not following the law themselves, but they do appeal to it, and they bring this up to Pilate as a reason why he should go ahead and go through with this. And then they introduce a new charge against him. They say, because he made himself the Son of God. Now, after this time, they've been calling him the king, that he was a threat to the Roman government because he declared himself to be a king, and Pilate had seen through that. He realized the man was no king. He was no threat to any kind of a government at all. And so now they say he's made himself the Son of God. And so they introduce a new phase in their charge against him, one that Pilate would take note of, because these paganistic people, like Pilate, had a very strong feeling for things that claimed to be gods. They thought that there were many gods, and for something to be a god then put a different light on this. It put a different character on the charge. He knew he wasn't a king, but he didn't know for sure that he wasn't a god. Here was a man that had a lot of authority, evidently. He had a lot of followers. He had created quite a stir, and he really couldn't get to the bottom of what the problem was. It had something to do with religion. And so when they say that he's made himself the Son of God, and Pilate takes a fresh look at the situation. So verse 8 says, "When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid." A new argument has now been interjected by the Jews, that of the fact that this man claims to be a god or the Son of God. And of course it was a very common thing for the Gentiles to believe in multiple gods. As idolaters, they believed that there were many gods, and even though they could come in and conquer another nation, they had fear for the gods of that nation. So here's a man who is claiming to be a god, and so he was the more afraid. This is a fresh perspective now that he has on the whole situation. It's no longer the fact that he's claiming to be a king, but now he's claiming to be a god. So verse 9 says, "And went again into the judgment hall, and saith unto Jesus." So now Pilate goes away from the Jewish mob, he leaves their presence and goes back into the judgment hall where he is. He's going to have more of an examination now. He wants to get more of this new charge back that he claimed God. And saith unto Jesus, whence art thou? He doesn't make the direct question, are you a God? But he simply asks him the question, where do you come from? Do you come from earth? Do you come from heaven? Just what is your origin anyway? And of course you can learn a lot about a person if you can know what that person's origin is. If you can know maybe what nationality or what kind of a family or what kind of a culture the person comes from. Well, if the man's a God, he's going to have some kind of an answer to this question that'll give you a clue as to whether or not he really is a God. And so he asked him the question, whence art thou? But Jesus gave him no answer. Here Jesus does not answer this question of Pilate. Now when the Jews asked him the question if he was the Son of God, he did answer that question to them. Here they had the law, they knew about the true and living God. They should have been able to have understood his answer. They should have been able to have known that he fulfilled the prophecies. But here this man Pilate, who was a pagan, who didn't know anything about the true and living God, who had only a concept of God as an idolater might have, he had no way of understanding the prophecies. He had no way of understanding the true answer. And so Jesus didn't. Jesus answered him. Had he convinced Pilate that he was truly a God, that he was truly the Son of the living God, then Pilate would not have had him crucified. And of course, had he not been crucified, what would have happened to our plan of salvation? How could we now get forgiveness of sin? So he had to be crucified, and one of the things that would be key to his crucifixion was Pilate allowing it to happen. And so Jesus didn't answer him. Here again we see this is a fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah 53, verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter. As a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. And so here was the part of his trial in which Jesus did not answer his judge. He also did not answer Herod. And so that prophecy was certainly fulfilled by the fact that Jesus gave him no answer. And so Pilate is now somewhat exasperated. Here's a man that won't answer the question. He will not really commit himself as to whether or not this is a true charge. And so in verse 10, then Pilate saith unto him, speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? So now Pilate begins to explain to him and to actually boast to him about the power that he has, about how the destiny of this prisoner is now in the hands of the man Pilate. And we see that Pilate did have a lot of power. In the eyes of man, he had a lot of power. But we see that Pilate, like most rulers, failed to understand the true nature and source of his power. Where Jesus says in verse 11, Jesus answered, thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin. So Pilate's power was actually a delegated power, as all of the authorities, all of the rulers of the nations, have their power also delegated to them by God. God is the one who sets up and removes kings. God is the one who uses nations as a tool, as an implement to carry out his will up here upon this earth. And they, in that sense then, are actually the ministers of God. And it's well if rulers could understand that. And it's well if those who are being ruled by the rulers could understand that. The Apostle Paul explains this more fully in Romans, the 13th chapter, beginning with the first verse of the 13th chapter. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So we see here very plainly that Pilate's power was simply a delegated power, delegated to him by God, actually. And it was so that God could use him as a tool to carry out his will here upon this earth. And that's true of all the rulers. And so we, as those that are being ruled, we who are the subject of these rulers, we need to understand this. And we need to do the best that we can to follow the law and order of the land, not to be rebellious, not to be lawbreakers, not to do anything that would cause an insurrection so far as the law goes, because we really are following along with God's will when we're in subjection to these rulers. Now, it's true that the rulers can do things that are bad. They can do things that are contrary to God's will. And, of course, they certainly will be punished for this. They will have to bear the responsibility of wrongful acts. And the same is true with Pilate. Pilate's authority was delegated, and Pilate was going to do something here that was unjust. He was going to crucify an innocent man. It would bring about the fulfillment of prophecies, but nevertheless, Pilate was acting by his own choice. He wasn't forced to do anything here. And so Jesus tells him this very plainly. He says that thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath a greater sin. Now, Pilate did have a sin here. He did do something that was wrong. Jesus calls it a sin, but it's not the greater sin. There's another sin that was committed here on this occasion by other persons that was greater than the sin of Pilate. So we see several things. First of all, sin seems to have some degrees. There are sins that we can think of as motes and sins that we can think of as beams. There are sins that are gnats and others that are camels. It doesn't change the fact, though, that it is a sin and it's going to be treated as a sin. But in Pilate's case, Pilate was acting more out of ignorance. He wasn't acting out of envy and hatred. He didn't really know the ramifications of all of this. He wasn't capable of understanding at this time the prophecies and the will of God and the fact that this was truly the Son of God, the Messiah. And so his was the lesser sin. The greater sin was the sin that those had that had delivered Jesus to Pilate. Now, Jesus is either talking here about the Jewish mob in general, the people that were turned against him, or he's talking about Caiaphas and those officials that are associated with him, the Sanhedrin, Herod, or he also could be talking about the fact that Judas had betrayed him. And I prefer to think that it has to do with all of these persons. Jesus was a stranger to Pilate, but Judas was his own familiar friend. These Jews had every opportunity to know that he was the Son of God. They experienced his miracles. They witnessed these miracles. They witnessed his teaching. He convincingly showed them that he fulfilled the scriptures, that he taught according to the prophecies, and he did fulfill these scriptures in such a plain way that they should have known that this was the Son of God. And so their sin, because they acted in a flagrant manner, there's no way that their sin could really be counted as a sin of ignorance. They went in a way that was open, haughty, deliberate. They deliberately did something here that they had to know that wasn't right. They knew this wasn't just. They weren't trying to follow justice at all. And so there then is sin is a haughty, deliberate, flagrant sin. And so it's a greater sin than the one of Pilate's. Pilate had a sin, all right. His sin will have consequences. He will have to answer for it in the judgment day. There's no question about that. But Jesus says that their sin was greater than the sin of Pilate's. And so when we're thinking about sin and the degree of sin, then we have to realize that there is a responsibility on our part. And whenever we fail to shoulder our responsibility, whenever we fail to go according to the things that we know that are best, that we know that are right, we don't use the knowledge that we have, then it makes our sin a much more heinous crime, because it then becomes a willful sin on our part. Not a sin of ignorance, not a sin that we accidentally stumbled into, not a sin that's due to some inadvertent action, but it's a sin that we do willfully because we go against the thing that we know to be the better judgment. And that's what these Jews were doing. They were putting an innocent man to death. They knew this. They didn't have any witnesses. They didn't have any real basis for it. They were simply wanting him put to death out of envy. They were changing their charges even so that Pilate would favor their cause. and theirs then was the greater sin. So verse 12 says, and from henceforth Pilate sought to release him. Now Pilate realized that he didn't have any true leg to stand on here so far as condemning this man. He realized that an injustice was going to be done, and so he sought to release him. He wanted him to be released. That was Pilate's objective. That was Pilate's goal, as John sees it here. He sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. So now the Jews resort back to this charge about him being a king. It kind of backfired on him when they charged him with being the Son of God in front of Pilate. This was more than Pilate could comprehend, and Pilate didn't really want to get involved in that. But now they go back to the charge of being a king. He said, if you let him go, you're not Caesar's friend. Now, that would be quite a charge, quite a put-down for Pilate, for the people to accuse Pilate of not being Caesar's friend. Well, Caesar was Pilate's master-in-chief. He was the one who put Pilate where he is. He was one to whom Pilate had to answer. And so they charge him with not being Caesar's friend. Whosoever makes himself a king speaketh against Caesar. Here's a king that's rebelling against Caesar, and so you're allowing it to go. You're not doing anything about it, and so you then are not standing up for Caesar. You're not defending your king. And so this would be a blow that would be hitting Pilate below the belt. Well, we have to close our lesson at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
When I'm feeling sad and blue, can't seem to know what's best to do. When it's hard to walk with men in sweet accord. When my plans have all gone wrong, when my poor heart has lost its song, I just kneel in secret prayer and tell the Lord. Oh, I know He'll hear my cry. Yes, He'll hear my deepest cry. I can count on Him, He's always nearby. When my load gets hard to bear, forget to care, I rejoice because I know He'll hear my cry. Jesus looks from heaven above.
approach that person. We then know what his attitude is. We then know what his general disposition seems to be. He's broken down the barrier. He's broken down the wall that might have been between us because he's communicated first. He's opened himself up to us, and it gives us an invitation then to respond. So that's the way the Savior did to these two disciples. Whenever they were seen by Jesus, he turned and saw them following. He takes note of us when we want to follow him, when we try to follow him. He sees it. He does not make it difficult for us. He turns and he looks and then he speaks. And he asked him the question, "What seek ye?" And you know, any time that we think about following the Messiah, that we think about taking up the Christian walk, we should ask ourselves this same question. It's a good question to ask because it helps to examine our motives. Do we claim to follow Christ and yet seek the world? Or do we continue to seek ourselves and our own personal gain? Or do we seek the praise of men and claim to follow Christ? If we do, we simply deceive ourselves. Or if in following Christ, we might ask ourselves, do we truly seek a teacher, a ruler, a reconciler? Are we willing to be taught by him? Are we willing to let him to mold